So we're carrying on with the story of market efficiency. If I can remind you, we're working with Fama's classification, three forms of market efficiency. Do you remember what they are? You need to know them. Weak form, semi-strong form, and strong form. And what I want you to do in your mind is associate each form of market efficiency with an information set. So a financial market that's consistently capturing in today's prices information about past prices, such a market is weak form efficient. A market that is consistently capturing in today's prices all forms of relevant public information is said to be semi-strong form efficient. Finally, it's an idealization. Nobody believes it's true in the real world. A market that could capture in today's prices all relevant information, be that public or private, that's a tall order, such a market would be said to be strong form efficient. So you must keep in your mind this clear mapping between the information set and the form of market efficiency. Now bear in mind, what moves prices in a financial market is new, relevant information. The information has to be relevant. And a financial market that's efficient can tell the difference between new information that's relevant and new information that isn't relevant. That's part of market efficiency. We then went on to look at some famous empirical tests of the so-called efficient markets hypothesis. So empirical means we're looking at real-world data. We're testing the hypothesis that the market is weak form efficient or semi-strong form efficient or, in an ideal world, strong form efficient. We're testing that hypothesis against a set of real-world data, observed data. That's what empirical testing means. We looked at a famous, admittedly quite old, but famous test by Bruno Solnit of weak form efficiency. We looked to see if there was evidence of statistically significant correlation between successive changes in the level of a particular stock market. Now, in order not to be accused of focusing unduly on a particular country's stock market, Solnit's study looked at stock market indices in a range of major economies. And again, in order to diffuse any criticism that he was focusing unnecessarily on a particular time interval, he looked at daily changes, weekly changes, and monthly changes. So it was a pretty comprehensive study. And what he found, and you have a table in your handout that lists the correlation coefficients, what he found was that none of them were statistically significantly different from zero. Now that's powerful evidence in favour of weak form market efficiency. It's weak form because we're looking at the ability of the market already to capture in today's prices what's already known about past prices. We're looking at successive changes in price from the most recent instant to the next instant to the next instant. And the fact that there's no statistically significant difference from zero means these changes are occurring by chance. We have no ability to forecast the next change, and therefore no real ability to make money. No real ability to beat the market on the strength of what we know about where has the price or the level of the market been in the past. We then went on to look at an even more famous study, again, really quite old, 40 years, but the reason why I tell you about it is it set the benchmark for any number of similar studies in more recent years. That was the so-called event study by Fama, there's that old Fama again, Fama, Fisher, Jensen and Rowe. Now, the particular event they looked at was what was called a stock split. But the event doesn't have to be a stock split, and indeed, subsequent studies have looked at different sorts of events, and you maybe want to read up a little bit about that by looking in the textbook. The FFJR, Fama, Fisher, Jensen and Rowe study, provides powerful evidence in support of the hypothesis that the US stock market, because all the firms they looked at were listed on the New York Stock Exchange, that study provides powerful evidence in favour of the hypothesis that the US stock market is at least semi-strong form efficient. Why is it semi-strong form efficient? Because we're talking about the responsiveness of the stock market to public information, new relevant public information. It's public information because it is tied up with the announcement that a company is going to have a stock split. An announcement makes the information public. And what we saw in the FFJR study was, relative to the announcement date, and those particular authors acknowledged they got that wrong in their initial study, and no subsequent study has ever got that wrong again. They should have anchored everything, their observations, to the announcement date, not the date of the stock split itself, which was some weeks later. But what they found was, once the announcement had been made, there was no evidence of further adjustment in the price. So the graph that I showed you was essentially horizontal to the right of the announcement date. So the market had no need to revisit the adjustment in price. It got it right first time. Another important finding is reflected by the fact that the graph is horizontal at the top. There's a vertical jump on the date of the announcement. In other words, the response is not just right, but it's immediate. So this market was performing very well along two of the key dimensions that I laid out for you for market efficiency at the beginning of the last lecture: speed and accuracy. Powerful evidence that the New York Stock Exchange was adjusting the share prices of the companies having these stock splits, was adjusting the price correctly and immediately. There was also some evidence to suggest that the stock market was anticipating some of the announcements. Not many, but there were some instances where the stock market was anticipating. How was it doing that? It was relying on the financial analysts who spend a lot of their time visiting company headquarters and interviewing, substitute for that word, interrogating, the senior officers, the chief executive officers, the chief financial officers, interrogating them about their plans for the future. And they were able to tease out of the senior people some relevant information that they then used to inform recommendations for trading. If they think they had picked up something positive and believable in the company's plans that the market didn't yet know, they wouldn't lose any time to get on the phone to the traders who worked with them for the same investment bank, buy more shares in this company. There's good news coming, and the market doesn't know it yet. So in that sense, and in a perfectly legal way, they were getting their hands on private information. That's not insider trading. That's being smart. That's a financial analyst justifying their huge salary. That's all part of teasing out private information to beat the market. So there's some evidence of that. But I want to go on now, continuing with the theme of semi-strong form efficiency, and you maybe want to note that down on this slide, that what we're talking about here is another empirical study that assesses the degree to which the US stock market is at least semi-strong form efficient. Another famous study by this guy, Michael Jensen. So this is the same Jensen as in Fama, Fisher, Jensen and Rowe. Harvard professor, another big name in academic finance. Now this diagram, this graph, we've seen it before, but we have yet to learn about it. We've yet to unpick all its richness, all its mysteries. So at the moment, I just want to point out to you that this diagram looks like something we've seen briefly before. Look along the horizontal axis. We're measuring risk. Not any form of risk, something called systematic risk. We don't know yet what that means. We won't know what that means until we hit the lecture on cost of capital. So I have to preface this by saying What's being measured along the horizontal axis in this diagram is the component of risk that financial markets reward with additional return. We will learn that not all forms of risk are rewarded by additional return. The market has no sympathy with investors who don't take the time and trouble to diversify away unnecessary risk. Systematic risk is risk that we cannot ourselves get rid of by diversifying. And diversifying is just a technical term for spreading our wealth across a number of different investment assets. More about that in the cost of capital lecture. We'll just understand this to mean the correct way to measure risk. And what we see in the diagram is an upward sloping straight line that seems to relate the level of risk to the level of return that's expected. And I've already hinted to you in an earlier lecture that that's what we expect to find as we go further into this story, into this subject of finance. So that upward straight line is going to be very important in this module. It's going to be given a name. It's called the securities market line. Again, we'll learn that in the cost of capital lecture. Let's use that as a benchmark of how much return we will expect for a given level of risk. Now let me explain, what are all the crosses and dots on the diagram? They represent actual investment funds. In America, they're known as open-ended mutual funds. Bit of a mouthful. In the UK, we would call them unit trusts. These are allegedly diversified portfolios of different investments, typically shares in different companies. So what each of these crosses and dots represents is the performance of a particular unit trust, a particular open-ended mutual fund. They're all US funds in this study that Jensen carried out. And what Jensen found was of his large sample of US open-ended mutual funds, they were pretty symmetrically distributed about this upward sloping straight line that defines for us the benchmark relationship between how much return to expect for a given level of risk. Symmetrically distributed. Roughly half as many funds plotted above the line as plotted below the line. In other words, on average, these funds neither outperformed the market or underperformed the market. That's a bit of a concern, because the managers who manage these funds charge high fees for their services. Yet on average, there's no evidence that these managers can consistently beat the market. But it's worse. Because if I draw your attention to the label on the vertical axis, it says gross returns. These are the rates of return that these funds achieved before we subtract the management fees. Now the investors, the clients of those fund managers, whose money it is that's being invested in these funds, what they care about is the rate of return after the manager has taken his bite, deducted his fees. When Jensen went back to his data, it's not shown in this diagram, when Jensen went back to his data and subtracted from the rate of return the management fee, which was typically about 1%, he found that all but one of these points plotted below the straight line. In other words, no real evidence to speak of any of these experienced, highly paid fund managers beating the market. And that's pointing up powerful evidence in favour of market efficiency. The market is already capturing, in today's prices, what is known and what matters. And no amount of effort on the part of the fund managers is able consistently to beat the market. Sure, in any one instance they can do so, but they just got lucky. They can't do it time and time again. So Jensen's study provides powerful evidence again in favour of semi-strong firm efficiency. Now, it might not surprise you to learn that the fund managers in the US weren't half upset when this study was published in the late 60s. And they tried to fight back. And the way in which they fought back was in two ways. One, they suggested that Jensen overestimated how risky their funds were. Now, you can see from the diagram that the further to the right you plot, the higher up you should plot. The higher the level of risk, the higher the rate of return. If you're overestimating the risk, you're setting too high a benchmark. And that was their first complaint, that he had overestimated the level of risk. And the second objection they raised was that he had failed to take into account with what they do about dividends. You see, the shares in the companies that these funds were investing in paid dividends during the year. And those fund managers would typically reinvest those dividends, they'd use the cash in the dividends to buy additional shares in those companies. And Jensen, they claimed, was failing to capture that. So they had two objections. One, you are plotting my fund too far to the right. It's not that risky. And B, you're underestimating how much return at the end of each year I can achieve because you're failing to account for the fact that dividends are being reinvested and therefore more value is being added to the fund. The debate raged for decades. Where is the debate today? I think the debate today would suggest there is evidence that a very small number of star fund managers, you might have heard of someone called Warren Buffett, for example, he's not the only one, a very small number of star fund managers may be able to beat the market in most years, but very few can. The fact that very few experienced and well-informed and highly trained fund managers can consistently beat the stock market is powerful evidence that the stock market is highly efficient. So again, that's pointing in favour of market efficiency. So why don't I just close the lecture down now and leave you with the story that financial markets generally are highly efficient? And the answer is because there are one or two phenomena out there that don't fall into line. They create a problem. And I just want you to have a little bit of awareness about them. Again, you can read more by looking in the textbook, for instance. What I want to tell you about in particular are something called calendar anomalies. Now, there's a question on the seminar sheet this week, a bit unfair for the Monday classes who might have attempted the last question on the sheet before today's lecture, so I apologise for that, but it's not possible always to get the scheduling just right. But the last question on the seminar sheet is about something called the small firm in January effect. And I can give you two reasons for wanting to know about the small firm in January effect. One, it's important. And two, I do have something of a habit of asking questions about that in the exam. So you might want to make sure you know something about the small firm in January effect. What I don't like, if I ask students to describe it, is if in their answer all they do is say back to me, word for word, what I've written in my own solutions. That isn't half boring when hundreds of students do that, answer after answer after answer. So this is a topic where I expect you to go to the textbook at the very least and read further. My answer is just the beginning. My answer to that last question on the seminar sheet is a skeleton answer. It's meant to be pointing you in the right direction, but I expect accounting and finance students, and you're all accounting and finance students, I expect you to go further and learn more yourself. So just be aware of that. So the small firm in January effect is an example, it's the most famous example of what I'm going to call a calendar anomaly. It's an anomaly for the efficient markets hypothesis. In other words, it's a problem. It doesn't fall into line. It doesn't reinforce the hypothesis that the market's efficient. It's pointing the other way. It's a problem for market efficiency. It's a calendar anomaly because it has to do with a phenomenon that repeats itself at a particular time in the year. In the case of the small firm in January effect, you've guessed it, it's in January. Actually, it's in the first five trading days of January. It's in the very beginning of January. So what is this small firm in January effect? Well, it refers to small firms. This is not a subject that's very imaginative when it comes to naming what it's talking about. So we're looking at the behaviour of small firms, i.e. firms with small market capitalisation. And you should remember from an earlier lecture what market capitalization means. You obtain it by taking the share price and multiplying by the number of shares. So as we'll come to learn in this module, market capitalization is the same thing as the market value of the equity of the company. If you take all the shares together, pile them up together, how much is that worth in aggregate? And the answer is the market cap. So small firms have small market cap. You're not going to find them in the FTSE 100. You're not likely to find them probably in the next 250 companies either. Possibly. But you're working your way down through the companies that make up the different FTSE indices. They're certainly not in the top 100. So what the observation is that the share price of these small market cap firms does particularly well relative to the stock market as a whole, relative to the large cap firms, in the first few days of January. Well, that needs a bit of explaining. But the problem that this phenomenon poses for market efficiency is that it was observed to happen every year throughout the 1980s and the first half of the 1990s. Then it seemed to go away. More recently, there are some hints that it's come back. So what we have here is an issue for market efficiency because it's a phenomenon that's repeating itself on cue. It's persistent. It's happening the same time each year, and therefore, and this is the key point, it's predictable. But phenomena that are predictable are a problem in general for market efficiency. At least they're a problem for market efficiency if we can make money from exploiting them. If there's some statistical significance, i.e. it's happening every year, year after year, it's not just down to chance, we might still be able to save the efficient markets hypothesis if we can demonstrate, well, it might be statistically significant, but it's not economically significant. In other words, when all's said and done, you can't make extra amounts of money from this. But what is the puzzle? The puzzle is that the share prices of these small cap firms were doing exceptionally well in the first few days of January every year. That being the case, I don't know about you, but if I had any spare cash, I wouldn't lose any time at all. I would buy some shares in these firms towards the end of December. I'd then do what all lazy people do. I'd fold my arms and I'd just wait to see what happens. I'd just wait for the outcome that I confidently expected, i.e. the share price will go up by more than the stock market as a whole, and then I'll cash in. I'll sell my shares for additional gain. I'm not allowed to do that if the market's efficient. That's me consistently beating the market if I'm doing this year in, year out. But let's think about it. It's not just me that's going to do that. You're going to do it as well. And everyone else who spots this pattern. Well, that excess demand for those shares is going to push their price up, sure. But what's going to happen is it's going to create excess demand for the shares in late December, and that in turn, as time goes on, is going to bring the effect forwards. It's no longer going to be the small firm in early January effect, it'll become the small firm in late December effect. But then by the same token, the excess demand is going to bring it further forward, so next time round, we'll start to observe the small firm in mid-December effect, as everyone piles in, trying to get in before everyone else, in order to make that extra gain. So the effect should migrate forwards in time. It should be coming back into December, gradually working its way through December. But that's not what's observed. What's been observed for about 15 years, all through the 80s and the early 90s, is the effect keeps showing up at the beginning of January. It's a real problem for market efficiency if we can actually make money out of it. And that's what I want you to read about. I want you to read about possible explanations for the small firm in January effect. Can we understand what's going on here? And then, as my answer suggests, when you come to read it, I want you to think seriously, is there a small firm in January effect, or are we missing the point? We might think we are observing what we call abnormal returns achieved by the shares of these small cap firms. But abnormal returns, by definition, are returns relative to a benchmark, just like the straight line that slopes upwards in Jensen's study. We've got to make sure we have the correct benchmark. And a benchmark adjusts for risk. But what if we're missing out on some forms of risk that should be priced? Maybe the benchmark we're using isn't demanding enough. We might be thinking we're observing positive abnormal returns, but maybe we should be setting a higher benchmark for the performance of those small cap firms because they're riskier than large cap firms. Maybe there's a flaw in our logic. That's what I want you to think about and possibly read a little bit from the textbook. And then the final thought I want to leave you with about market efficiency is irrational exuberance. Have you ever heard of Alan Greenspan, a former governor of the US Fed? The US is equivalent of our Bank of England. He coined this phrase, irrational exuberance. He coined this phrase whilst we were going through the so-called dot-com bubble. So here's another issue for the efficient markets hypothesis. If the markets are truly efficient, then prices should reflect fundamentals. Fundamental information about the health of the company. So the cash flows that we forecast that the company will generate from its operations, the forecasts we go on to make about the size of the dividends per share that the company will pay its shareholders, these are fundamental considerations. We can drill down, we can point to the source of this value, and the share price should reflect that. But there are points in financial history when share prices have departed significantly from fundamentals. We talk about there being bubbles, asset bubbles appearing. And a famous recent example was a so-called dot-com bubble in the late 1990s, when investors were falling over themselves to invest in the shares of these new startup companies that were exploiting the internet. This was the fad in the late 90s, and I'm ashamed to admit, I put some money in it myself, and I lost heavily. So no amount of reading the textbooks could teach me common sense, because I fell for the trick that other people fell for. I got carried along with the sense of excitement. Oh, this is the latest new thing to come about, too good to miss. I've got some spare cash, put it in. Other people were doing the same. In other words, there was a herding behaviour. Investors were falling over themselves to get a piece of the action whilst it was still relatively cheap to do so, and in the expectation that they'd make a lot of money. And what the graph shows, the graph is taken from an edition of The Economist, but the graph itself in The Economist is taken from a book by a guy called Robert Shiller, another big name in academic finance, Yale University. He wrote a book called Irrational Exuberance. You don't have to go off and read it. He took the title from this famous quote from Alan Greenspan. And what I want you to see that the graph is illustrating is there have been points in the past. Look how far back this goes. It goes back to the beginning of the 1900s. There are points in the graph where valuations have moved far away from what I might term common sense, from fundamentals. When people stopped to look at it closely, they couldn't begin to justify such high valuations. That's a problem for market efficiency. There should not be any asset bubbles in a highly efficient market. So again, there's evidence there that causes a challenge to the efficient markets hypothesis. And I'd just like you to know a little bit about that.